You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Hi, everybody. This is Tom Shade, and this is another episode of The View. This is a special episode. We are reporting from 24 Farnsworth Street, the headquarters, the intergalactic headquarters of the Unitarian Universalist Association. And I'm here because I'm participating in the second economics summit on the sustainability of ministry. Economic sustainability of ministry has been a concern of the UUA for many reasons. It touches every kind of aspect of our congregational culture. Can we afford our ministers? Can our ministers afford the education that we require them to get? How do we sustain our association? How do we fund the programs we want? Is this ministry thing that we're trying to do economically sustainable in the 21st century? So this is big issues, big stuff. This conference is called together by the Office of Church of Staff Finances and the Department of Religious Professional Leadership, the entity formerly known as the Department of Ministry back in the old day. We've been meeting and today and heard a keynote last night, but a meeting today, and we've been focused on two different subjects. One is unleashing the power of lay ministry, and the other has been changing our relationship with money in our congregations. And we're going to bring you a couple of people who were involved in both sessions and both work groups and talk about what they talked about. But our first guest is the Director of Outreach for the UUA, Kerry McDonald. And Kerry and I were in the session on unleashing lay ministry. And we started out by having a long discussion about a friend of Kerry's. Kerry has imaginary friends. So don't.
You say it like I'm the only one.
Well, people have imaginary friends when their children grow up to have imaginary enemies when they're when they're adult. But anyway, tell me about your friend, Allie.
Thanks, Tom. And it's great to be here. Actually, I often call this the mothership.
The mothership?
The mothership, yeah, I work with the mothership.
Oh, okay.
So it's great to be here with you all. And our session, or our part of this discussion, was called Unleashing the Power of Lay Ministry, because I think that's the real key here, is to recognize that there's a lot of wonderful ministry happening right now, and there's a lot of potentially wonderful ministry that could happen, but is locked into a duality of the system that we have, ordaining ministers in this specific process geared towards certain specific outcomes, and then nothing else. So we're trying to explore what's in between that, what's authentically Unitarian Universalist, and a great place to start that conversation is actually with our imaginary friends, who are not imaginary so much as composites of lots of experiences that folks are actually having. So Allie is one of our personas that we put together to build some empathy and start from centering a different experience than the institution, which is where institutions usually start. What are our goals? What do we want to accomplish? And that's legitimate, but it also inherently limits the conversation. So what if we centered someone else's experience and got outside our own senses of what we need to do? What does that open up?
So when you say centering our own institutional experience, that would be like for us to get together and say, sitting around the table saying, we're the UUA and how can we get lay ministers and what kind of lay ministers do we want to have so that we can maximize our goals. And
we want to grow lay ministry. So how do we make more lay ministers?
Right. So you're starting instead with
the people who we might ostensibly think
Who want to be lay ministers, and one of them is your imaginary
and
friend.
One of them is my close personal composite friend, Alan.
Oh, close personal composite friend. And, I like that.
So just a note about these.
If I had more than one friend, I'd make a composite friend.
So they're based on the data that we have about who participates in lay leadership programs right now, who considers the path to ordination, who is engaged in Unitarian Universalist leadership at congregational and associational levels for youth, adults, young adults. So that's the demographic background, and then we kind of put some flesh on those demographic bones with a story and a name and a Creative Commons picture. So this is Allie.
Whoa.
And Allie is...
I think I saw her the other day over at Flower, the...
the bakery next door.
The bakery next door.
Right. So Allie is just out of college. She's in her early 20s and really committed to Unitarian Universalism. She grew up UU. She was super involved as a youth leader and even in her college setting, and cares a lot about social justice and maybe reproductive justice, and is trying to figure out how she can stay connected to her faith, to embody her faith in this next phase of her life, recognizing that that's a question that can't be separated from her professional pathways, her financial realities of being a young person who has student debt and works on Sundays, and that means it's hard to go to church, right? So Allie is one of the people that we said, okay, if we imagine that Allie is someone who could be doing great lay ministry if empowered and equipped to do so, what would it have to that experience have to be like to be really valuable and engaging for Allie?
I think I know Allie, and I think a lot of our listeners know Allie as well.
A lot of Allies.
A lot of Allies. And so what? So the question that you're asking is, what would we have to do to help Allie become the kind, have the life that a lay ministry would have that would help her reach this goal, even presenting to her this as a goal in her life, that possibility of becoming a lay minister in Unitarian Universalism. So what kind of stuff do you think that is? What's Allie looking for?
Yeah, so, and just to note, we were working with Allie, and we were also working with Karen.
And we're going to have one of Karen's friends on.
We're going to talk to Karen's friends, great. So we were working with Allie and Karen.
Okay.
That's the point. So we talked about what would make this experience valuable and what would be really meaningful for Allie and where she is in life and in her location in our faith movement. And we talked about personal transformation. So how does she help embody her values, her religious identity in all aspects of her life? We talked about social transformation, which is how Allie is helping to make the world a better place. She cares deeply about justice issues, not in the abstract. She wants to be doing work to address them right now in her community, in her world, in our world. So disconnect. It doesn't work if that's a thing that we study over here and not a thing we are doing from the beginning. Purpose, a sense of what you are, what and who you are called to be, and an element that I think maybe we haven't talked about enough in the past, which is not community for the sense of community, but community for the sense of cohort, and the mutual accountability of being in a group of people who are your peers, or people who are your mentors who can inspire you, or peers that inspire you. In an ongoing kind of relationship as you struggle with the formation of being a leader, someone doing ministry in the world and in your life. So those are the kinds of things that we really, that we see Allie would have to be able to see as real.
So what you're saying is that you want, that Allie needs opportunities for her own personal growth and transformation. That Allie wants to work in a process of social transformation. That Allie needs a group of people to be working with, both as peers and mentors to inspire her. And Allie, what's the fourth one? Allie needs to identify a sense of purpose in her life that is being, that can be met by lay ministry.
That's right.
So that's what we're looking for. For that, and what kind of experiences do you think that turns into?
Well, I think there's a lot of experiences that are happening right now, but maybe aren't tied together in that way, and certainly more we can imagine. But this was actually one of the themes of our conversation, is that there's, again, a lot of lay ministry, great lay ministry preparation, training, and ministry itself going on right now, and how can we elevate that and recognize and affirm that and empower it. So We talked about mentoring. We talked about building those small group cohort peer structures. We talked about experiential learning, like really investing yourself in an immersive experience. We talked about rituals that mark and mark growth. Mm-hmm. And we talked about the fact that there's also going to need to be different paths. Mm. We're talking about Ali, but there's never going to be one size fits all.
Yeah, we're going to bring in Sarah Lammert in a minute here to talk about her imaginary friend, Karen, and talk about Karen's potential path to lay ministry. But let me just tie this back. Why is it a question of the economic sustainability of ministry that Ali has an opportunity to become a lay minister? What's the connection there?
Yeah. There's a joke, except it's not that funny, that people who grow up UU either go to seminary or leave the faith.
Hmm.
And we want the
people... It's a lot cheaper to leave the faith.
It's a lot cheaper to leave the faith. We want the people who want to go to seminary and follow the path to ordained ministry to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We think that more leadership
that
ministry
option.
Opportunities will help that happen. But you're leaving a lot of great leaders out not knowing where to go or how to realize their ministry. If we want to grow our faith's impact and relational networks in the world, we're going to need more people to do that. We're going to need to be able to deploy more people in more contexts and empower them to do that.
Well, thanks, Carrie. I'm going to have Sarah Lammert come in here and talk some more about Karen, the other person we talked about in preparation, in thinking about lay ministry, and also to talk some more about what you guys came up with, what we all came up in that discussion. So
Great. Thanks
very much, Carrie.
Thanks, Tom.
Come again. As we switch our set here at the View Studio, I'm bringing in Sarah Lammert, who is, what's your exact title, Sarah? I always muffle this and end up making a bad joke, but she's getting her earplugs.
Leave yourself muted too. We're all offering off the Tom's mic so that we don't get everybody.
How can that be? I'm all plugged. Oh, you're offering this mic.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it's working great, so.
There we are.
You can actually you can leave your headphones on, but don't unmute yourself or they'll be.
All right. Hi, Sarah.
Yes.
Sarah, what's your title again?
It's the Director of Ministries and Faith Development.
Okay, there you are. Well, Carrie was telling us about one of his imaginary friends, Ali, and I understand you have an imaginary friend who you think might be thinking about lay ministry. So can you tell us about your friend, Karen?
Yeah. So Karen is a white female, aged somewhere around 55 to 65,
mm-hmm.
who works in human health services. She's a mental health counselor. She is divorced with adult children. She owns a home in her community, and she's one of those Uber church volunteers who's done everything at the congregation. And she's at a phase in her life where she's looking for something more, something that she can do in this next chapter will leave a legacy and make a difference.
So she is the church lady, you know, as we used to call them, who has done everything in the congregation. I think she's been a board president and so on, and has been a worship associate, a worship leader, maybe a pastoral care associate, and now is looking for that next step, especially as she approaches her own retirement.
Yeah, exactly.
And is going to have more time and without the purpose that her professional job has kind of driven her to all these years. So why would she, and so she wants to become a lay minister, or she might, our thinking is that these people, these composite persons are actually people who would be open to the suggestion of lay ministry if it was offered to them in a way that that fit their lives and their learning needs.
Well, we're starting with personas who maybe represent the typical center of our current makeup of Unitarian Universalists, but there are, of course, many other kinds of people who might be drawn to this path of wanting to live out some kind of ministry as you use in the world. without having to do the entire seminary track.
Mm-hmm.
So at age 65, to take that on, it really may not be the thing. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But she wants to have a path that expresses her Unitarian Universalist ministry in the world. She wants to be recognized for the work she's done, and she wants an opportunity to deepen in and make a greater impact in her own community.
You think that one of the differences between Allie, who's younger, and Karen, is that Karen's preparation for this moment has been largely in her own congregation, and while Allie has been is no longer in that congregation where she grew up as a young adult, she's moved away, and that Karen wants to probably serve in her own congregation, while Allie is not. Doesn't know where she wants to serve necessarily, or may want to serve in the community as a community organizer in some other way. Is that?
Well, Karen doesn't want to move.
Right.
And
she owns a house.
She's, you know, she's a mental health worker. She's got some assets, but she doesn't have money to just do whatever the heck she wants.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got deep roots in her community. So she's not planning to go anywhere.
So we're looking at lay ministry as having, just in, by these two composite profiles of people who are potentially right out there and who are already expressing in individual forms an interest in lay ministry as one path leading into congregations where people have been, and another path leading outside of congregations or into the community as a whole, right?
Yeah.
How do you think the experience that Karen needs is different than the experience that Allie needs?
Well, Karen needs to get outside of her community probably as one of her formational experiences.
You mean like outside of her congregation?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe even a time away from her community, an immersion situation. I mean, Allie's got all sorts of leadership experience beyond the congregation. She's been at General Assembly. She's done all these camps and things. We don't know if Karen has had a lot of those opportunities, but she needs to encounter a community of difference along the way.
Well, sometimes, you know, this is why if people don't do their internship in their home congregation if they're on the ordained track, is that you're already cemented into your identity in that, and you really can't imagine a different way of being until you're kind of in a new situation and can kind of...
Yeah, I have to say, my first experience, you know, I became a Unitarian Universalist at First Church in Jamaica Plain, and I thought all Unitarian Universalist churches were family-sized churches in neighborhoods, like, just like that, and I could not have been more wrong, so it was a great experience to get out of that, you know?
Right, and the other part of that is that you thought you were the kind of church person that they thought you were, and that was really probably an only a small slice of what you could be. So Karen needs to get, even though she's aimed perhaps back at her home congregation, she needs experiences in her formation that take her away from that, where she works in another situation. And what else do you think Karen needs in that?
Doesn't really know what ministry is relative to lay leadership. And so that is a deepening she's going to have to do. We're not out to create competing centers of power that will undermine the ordained minister who's already serving a congregation. We're looking for spiritually and emotionally mature people who have an opportunity to form into a deeper understanding of what ministry is, empathize with their own professional minister, and know the difference in their role so that they can serve alongside flanking the ministry of the person already called as the main shepherd of that community.
And inside congregations, lay ministers can serve a whole lot of different roles. They can be educators. They can be doing pastoral care. They can be worship associates. They can be worship leaders in situations. They can be administration. People involved in administration as well. So, there are people out there who are training lay ministers in different ways around the country. I understand you went. Well, we talked about a list of those people. Why don't you go over who's doing something on this already?
They've been doing it, some of them, for 40 or more years.
My goodness.
But in isolation from one another. So in Canada, there's a long tradition of having lay chaplains. which comes from a time when there were only 3 ordained UU ministers in the entire country. And so they needed more ministers to do rites of passage. And mm-hmm. that community built came from that. But it's evolving now.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, they have a pretty sophisticated system where there can be 1 lay chaplain for every 100 members in a congregation. The Ohio Meadville District has a commissioned lay leader program that involves training, mentoring, evaluation, a board that reviews you every 3 years. So that's a pretty well-developed program, and they're in the process of renewing that and rolling it out for the whole region now, regionalizing.
Can we go back to this fascinating ratio you just threw out, that it's you're allowed 1 lay chaplain in a Canadian church per 100?
Per 100.
The
They've somehow come to this
1%
idea.
1% somehow,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm,
Wow. Well, what do you think that is all about? Like, was it someone, did they feel like there was a danger of a glut of too many chaplains
inside
a congregation?
It's possible. I have heard that they have less rites of passage per chaplain to do now. So maybe they just discovered some happy balance there.
Yeah, Sean Newton from Toronto said that when the state, the government started saying, started making officiants available through the what we would call the justice of the peace to do weddings, the need for lay chaplains went down because for a long time, I guess, only designated religious leaders could do weddings in Canada.
Right. And remember, they have a specific understanding of lay ministry that does not involve a lot of other functions besides rites of passage there.
I know some of the schools, you know, Meadville, Lombard, and Star King are offering programs that prepare people for certain kinds of lay ministry.
Star King has a certificate program in Unitarian Universalist Studies, which some of our religious educators have done in preparing for credentialing programs. And other lay people can take that certificate course. And then Meadville has a new master's program in lay leadership with a concentration in lay ministry. That is just beginning, and we'll have a whole cadre of people who are interested and trained for lay ministry without a clear pathway or system of accountability for that unless we get out in front of this course a little
bit. Yeah, and that's an 18-month program, too. So for
it's
folks,
rigorous.
I can't help looking at you instead of looking at the camera, so it makes for bad video. Good thing we're doing a podcast of this. But yeah, so 18 months is a much better, it's a lower financial cost also, and that's 18 months that's 18 months less that you're not out of that you're out of the workforce. A big help. So
yeah.
And interestingly, Karen is their biggest audience for that program in terms of their research of and their marketing.
Karen being the baby boomer, right? Looking for so the UUA is going to take over all these programs and meld them into one and make them meet a common standard. And you as the director of the Department of Faith Development and Ministries, will be in charge of all of this. Is that what I heard today?
Yeah. No.
I must have fallen asleep at that part.
Yeah. The UUA has a role in this. We're convening the conversation, and I think we have an interest in seeing that this network is doing a thoughtful program in terms of training and having codes of ethics that people are accountable to. But the days are long gone when the UUA has the kind of resources or even the mandate to create comprehensive programs that will manage every aspect of all ministry out there in UU land. The nature of congregation and church is just changing too quickly, and we are finding ourselves in a new role of being the connective tissue, of curating resources, but not trying to dictate every policy for every lay ministry. I mean, the fact is it's happening out there. How many congregations have pastoral associates or lay ministers? Many, and it's exciting. And then we have new forms of ministry popping up, like Sanctuaries DC, where you have a real cohort of artists who are leading individual groups with just some guidance and mentoring from 2 professionals.
So you're saying at this point is let's let everybody who wants to train lay ministers in the UU universe to go ahead and to start working on that and to sit together at a table and try to share best practices and more or less let 100 flowers bloom at this point in terms of developing lay ministry and without having a centralized...
I think that's right. I think we'll start small and experiment. Mm-hmm. We aren't going to have a big name for this or a stole that we hand out or a symbol, but we hope to eventually
get
there.
I was hoping for a sash.
A sash would be nice.
You know.
And the other thing I'll add to your metaphor of the 1,000 flowers is someone here said 1,000 flowers, but we know the difference between the flowers and skunkweed.
Yeah.
So there is a discernment and a weeding out that will also have to happen, but it's not going to be just the UUA taking that role.
Well, that sounds hopeful. For the future, and I hope that it happens. So,
I hope we unleash a lot of spiritual power out there in the Unitarian Universalism.
Great. Well, thanks very much for coming in, Sarah. And it's been a great conference, and thanks for putting it on. I've enjoyed it greatly. And it keeps going. But the other half of the conference today...
Should I?
Yeah, step on in. The other half of the conference today was... The other half of the conference today was another group that was meeting around generosity and stewardship, and today we have one of the people who was involved in that group also with us, Vale Weller. Vale, why don't you, you have a title at the UUA. And what is that?
I am the Congregational Giving Director.
Okay.
And that means that I manage the annual program fund and gift in the southern region. And I just previous to that, I was working doing, focusing on major donors who had more generosity than they could reasonably share with their individual congregations and who wanted to support Unitarian Universalism. Mm-hmm. But what I tell people is that this, I'm bringing that sensibility to this work because, in fact, our congregations are our major donors to our association. And so bringing that understanding and appreciation to those relationships and encouraging people to give out of a sense of commitment to the covenant that we're already in.
So that's you. And so what... what did you guys talk about in that other room where Sarah and I and Carrie were talking to each other in another conference room about their imaginary friends?
Right. Creating personas.
Creating avatars.
Avatars. That was funny when someone said that. We talked about how, you know, our vision being integrating stewardship into our lives as Unitarian Universalists, and what would that look like, what would that feel like, what might be different if that were the case. And so we each shared stories of challenge from our particular sort of constituencies standpoint. Failures, breakdown of our ability to do that. And then we shared stories of hope. And then we moved into a real place of possibility, unfettered, you know, vision about if resources were no object, what would it look like if stewardship was fully integrated into our life as Unitarian Universalists?
So you're really not looking at just how do we get to the point where we have enough money?
No.
You're looking at like how do we change our culture so that stewardship is an integral part of our religious life.
We talked about the culture in which we live as being one that is ill. The lie of consumerism is the air that we breathe, and we're all a part of it. You know. To varying degrees, but none of us can escape that that's the context in which we live.
And how would you define that lie? What is the lie of consumerism?
That life is about accumulating wealth and things and individual success. All of those things are, you know, a falsehood in one way or another. And so, and I, you know, we talked about, well, just digress a little bit, that like the times in my life, I don't know, for you, and I would invite people who are watching to think about when was the time in your life that you felt most fulfilled, most alive, most rich?
Hmm.
And for me, it was a time when I was not making a lot of money.
Right.
But my life was spiritually very, like, pulsating with meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I was grateful all of the time. I was surrounded by beauty. Mm. I was eating simply.
I got to know what you were doing.
Oh, I was in seminary.
so it was my full-time job to be,
grateful.
Walking around reading poetry and, writing. But
no offense to me, Jill, but it's not been my seminary experience.
Well, it's different for each of us, but...
I love
but,
you, though. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, of course.
And also the age at the age at which we go to seminary,
right.
Because those kinds of peak experiences are often in our younger life when we don't have as much money as we may have later in life. But yet, we're still, because life is, our adult life is still new, we're closer to meaning. And this lie of consumerism overrides whatever purpose you have in life. Eventually, you begin to get more and more, your goals tend to get more and more material.
Things
you know,
change. But
then... Getting bitter.
What?
Inevitably.
Right. Grim, sad life.
There's a spiritual component to our relationship with that money that you're paying.
Absolutely.
But then to move to at least my experience with folks at the end of life, what they are thinking about,
mm-hmm.
if they have the good fortune to know that they are about to die,
mm-hmm.
and not all of us have that experience, they're not talking about, they wish they had attended more meetings. They're not talking about, I wish I had that, additional Mercedes.
Mm.
They are thinking about the time spent with loved ones, what
mm-hmm.
beauty they experienced and created,
mm-hmm.
what they are leaving behind, not in a material
mm-hmm. form. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's... So we spent a lot of time talking about how, in each of our sort of purviews, how
mm-hmm.
are we helping to address that sickness in our culture, which
mm-hmm.
I want to also say seems to be at the root of so much of the pain and, I want to use really strong words,
Go ahead. This is the view.
What we're seeing in our political moment,
mm-hmm.
So much of this relates back to materialism
mm-hmm.
and wealth and individualism without an understanding of our interbeing,
mm-hmm.
our interconnectedness, the fact that anything that I have, from material goods to whatever beauty I may possess, intelligence, it's all temporary,
mm-hmm.
and it's all a gift that passes through our lives that we've done nothing to earn. That's not the way things are being talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I call it a lie, because I feel like that's not the reality, but we're out of step with that true center. So
mm-hmm.
so we talked about all of that, and then we tried to distill it down to something practical.
Mm-hmm.
And we were careful and thoughtful about not trying to take on
mm-hmm.
Everything.
Right.
How many times have we tried to do...
All right, we're going to change the whole culture.
Right.
Everything.
Right.
Everybody's attitude toward money and institute, kind of utopian socialism, and then we'll get...
I love the sound of that.
The churches will be happy
I'm
then.
I'm for that, but I think, we all have to come at it
uh-huh.
in many... We all have to come at it in different ways. So it boiled down to... There was a lot of resonance with the idea of owl for money.
Okay, owl.
Like the owl concept.
Our whole lives.
Our whole lives, which is the sexuality education curriculum. People understand that why that's powerful. Owl is like a signifier for something that is traditionally, scary to talk about. And
we're
not only talking about it, but we're grounding it in our deepest values.
Uh-huh.
Now, the point was made, which I thought was very, very wise, that OWL, the OWL program as it currently exists, is really a Trojan horse.
Uh-huh.
It's we think that it's about sex, but it's really about respect and relationships. So similarly, if we had a curriculum that was about OWL for me,
I hear you.
Picking up from where the Wisdom Path materials leave off. Now I want to mention, put in a plug for the Wisdom Path materials, which are made possible by support for the annual program fund and gift. Sorry. But
No, that's okay.
That was very elegantly done.
Yeah, very elegantly we dug that. Remember that the view is brought to you by your contributions to the Church of the Larger Fellowship.
So that's good, in fact. We're all grateful for what we do.
Onward we go.
But the Wisdom Path curriculum is easily adaptable to a variety of different lengths of use.
Right.
And it's really about personal history with money. And and there's great value in it, and we heard testimonials from people who've been using it in their congregations to great effect. Like super, super great testimonials about it I heard today. And only the teeny tiny bit of it is about personal finance or anything related to giving to support your faith. That's not what it's about. So we were saying OWL for Money was the project that we want to think about and potentially encourage, take up, assist with. And it picks up then where the Wisdom Path curricula leaves off. And the Wisdom Path, I want to just say, is available free online all of the time on our website. It's one of the Tapestry of Faith curricula. Okay. So what we came to about OWL for Money is there would be, like OWL, there would be different age-appropriate groups. So one would be for young people, for kids, and one would be for young adults to help them learn about credit cards and saving for future educational endeavors, whether college or other priorities. One would be for people facing midlife because they have particular need for thinking ahead. And
One of the things about young adults often is that for the first time they're buying a home.
Yes.
Which is a huge but it's a huge financial decision-making process, which a lot of people are unprepared for.
Totally. And how does that all work and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then another segment would be for those closer to retirement, thinking also about legacy.
Yeah.
But then there are two other sort of constituencies that we wanted to create tracks for. One is prospective religious leaders. We spent a lot of time talking in our group about can you center your head, Tom?
Oh. All right. I'm sorry. I was slumping over in the chair.
I was waiting for him to see it. I was like.
Okay. All right.
We spent a lot
Someone's
of time.
Sure, our toy backstage chatter. Right?
Sorry. Yeah,
I was so caught up in everything you were saying.
That's so great. That's
you know
so
that I just you I lose consciousness of myself.
Thank you.
You know.
Oh my gosh! Woo!
Yeah, I know.
So the other one we spent a lot of time talking about ministers as folks who are just as wounded as everybody else in the culture, and frankly, woefully underprepared to lead a nonprofit institution. And so the track that would be for prospective religious leaders would include not only theology of money and doing some of that personal work, but also we talked about other potential workshops for helping ministers and potential religious leaders. Learn about budgets and learn about spreadsheets. It's not as though all of us come with that knowledge already in us. Some do from previous work.
Many of us have gone into ministry because we hated that sort of stuff.
Like, wait a minute, how did I get caught up?
Now all of a sudden,
this stuff.
Right, this is what I was trying to avoid.
Right. And the other track would be lay leaders, that we wanted people who were leaders in their congregation to have also a track of this OWL for Money. To learn how to talk about money and ask for it. So
one of the things that I really appreciate when I heard about this OWL for Money, which basically comes down to like all ages, all situations, financial, money, education, and self-reflection about it, is that in the past, it seemed often that when Unitarian Universalists approached this question, one of the watchwords was voluntary simplicity. Uh-huh. And that seemed was like a big thing, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the problem I always had with that was that it was so class biased, you know, that if you were a genuinely poor person, that going to a church that advocated that, you know, the solution was for you to be into voluntary poverty or voluntary simplicity.
You're like, wait a minute.
Wait a minute.
I'd like to start with some non-poverty first.
Right, I like some, yeah, this is involuntary simplicity.
Exactly.
You know, and this is something that, this Owl for Money seems like the kind of program that you could offer to everybody in your mm-hmm. congregation at every economic level mm-hmm. that would be affirming and supportive and help them reflect on with the choices that they're making mm-hmm. at this point, even if their choices don't seem much like choices. So that, I think, is like it's a good thing. And it's also, I have to say, it's like the owl about sexuality is, I think, a great outreach program that most churches could offer that in their community to people with great, you know, people would be interested. There's a hunger out there for it, and the soul sickness of consumerism that you talk about is not just us Unitarian Universalists,
no,
but it's everybody.
Definitely not.
You know, and
it may be a case of people not knowing exactly what they want,
mm-hmm.
or that that's what they're wanting, or not knowing that that's what they need.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a role where I feel like our congregations and mm-hmm. covenanted communities can play a role in worship and in other ways, mm-hmm. helping people face
mm-hmm.
The ways in which we are
mm-hmm.
disconnected, cut off mm-hmm. from our real center.
Mm-hmm.
And also the Dave Ramsey Financial Peace University.
Mm-hmm.
I hear a lot of my non-UU family members, friends, colleagues talking about it, and they use it as a great tool for mm-hmm. serving the larger community. Come mm-hmm. on in and learn with us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, mm-hmm. you know, we could be doing something similar in our own
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm. One of the people in the today quoted Kenny Wiley, who's been on The View many times, saying that if Unitarian Universalist churches only talked about sex, money, and race, we would have a plenty on our plate and would serve a great purpose in the world.
And we would be ever more relevant to the issues that are truly concerning the people in our culture.
In our culture,
yeah.
In our communities.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Vale.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm glad
thanks,
to be.
Thanks, Bob.
My pleasure. Thank
well,
you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. And for our final guest on today's View from the Summit on Economic Sustainability,
hey.
Is my good friend and mentor, the inimitable Don Southworth, who is the executive director of the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association. As many as years I've worked with you, why would I blow that title at this point?
I don't know.
Don, what have you been thinking about the economic sustainability of ministry as you have observed this conference from your viewpoint as the executive director of the UUMA?
Well, it's great to spend time together with people across our faith traditions thinking
mm-hmm.
and talking about this.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's the second one we've done and been part of, and it's just such an important topic in so many different ways.
Well, it seems like we're getting at the real stuff about what makes this thing work, and sustainability is always, it's the crucial issue in any kind of endeavor.
Well, and one of the things that I kind of raised at the very beginning this morning's conversation was, we talk about stewardship and covenant and really important words that mm-hmm. we use a lot, and, you know, somebody who's been doing stewardship development training
mm-hmm.
Ever since I got in the ministry,
mm-hmm.
and so, to be honest, before that, is like, I wonder, and what we got to with our whole lives for money, which I know mm-hmm. you're talking with Vale with, is that there's so much brokenness
mm-hmm.
Around our relationships with money.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as somebody who's kind of personally gone through a transformation and becoming a tither and all this stuff, it's like stewardship and generosity are so core to what we are, and we have to address, just we have to talk about money, not just on Stewardship Sunday. We have to talk about money all through the year and how it affects our lives. So like Kenny's quote was so great, because sex, money, and race, that if we could really dive deeply into those conversations, all three of those conversations are really hard to have.
Right.
In our families, in our workplace, where can we have those conversations? We would hope in our religious communities. The truth is, it's tough in those, right?
Yeah,
and so, you know, for me, especially as the ministers, I mean, I've always believed, rightly, wrongly, that as leader, faith leaders, and it's just not ministers, it's religious educators, musicians, but we have to, especially as ministers, we have to have a story about theology, money, and our own experience of, you know, there was just an article in The Atlantic that half the people in America have shame, you know, about half the people couldn't raise $400 for an emergency, right?
Yeah.
We just don't talk enough about those deep places of what we learned. Sometimes it was we didn't have enough and we got shame. Sometimes it's we had too much and we have shame. You know, so I think, I mean, we know that when we do training on this stuff, people don't show up.
Yeah, because it's still too painful. I've been just reflecting on the change. You know, because you want to say, how can we, can you imagine a culture in which Unitarian Universalist churches were centers of education and reflection about money? And you think back to when AYS came out about your sexuality, which was, you know, 50 years ago, perhaps, I don't know, somewhere around that period, 40, 50 years ago. And at that point, that was quite shocking. That, and many Unitarian Universal churches were like, very reluctant to take that on, and it was a kind of an uphill battle, and a lot of people thought it was a good idea except for their kids. You know, and yet we've changed that culture in Unitarian Universalist congregations. Absolutely. Most people say at this point they're proud of the fact that we offer OWL, and they are pleased to do it, and I said earlier today that I know a congregation that's on fire with the idea of presenting it in the larger community. So it is possible to change our basic culture, and I imagine that there someday we will be talking about money as freely and as value-oriented as we talk about sexuality now, and that someday we'll be able to talk about race in that same way. So,
and I think the conversations are... what we have to do is so similar in all the conversations. Mm-hmm. We have to be vulnerable and be able to risk being vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's talking about our sexuality, whether it's talking about race, whether it's talking about money.
Could you imagine a congregation where everyone agreed to tell each other publicly how much they made?
Oh my God.
We are that open now about our sexuality. Absolutely.
Yeah, maybe you are, Bob.
We're getting there. Right?
I think there's
I always use this example because I started when I was in seminary, I started teaching this to seminarians because I used to teach a course called Financial Manager for People Who Don't Want to Bother, which kind of defines a lot of ministers. And hopefully we get better. But I always remember this one woman who was in her 20s and was a lifelong UU. She was like $75,000 in debt. So I was coaching her and talking, and said, "So tell me about what, like, when you grew up, what did you talk about?" And she was very clearly, very open about her sexuality, bisexual, and we talk about sexuality stuff all the time around the dinner table. I said, "So what kind of conversations did you have about money?" We never talked about money, you know. And I think that's indicative of not just Unitarian Universalism, but the idea of really. I mean, I always say that one out of four stories in the Bible are about money and resources. And it's not because the Bible was written to say, let's write this so we can have a really good stewardship drive next year. it was written to help people live their lives. And,
right.
You know, especially these days with the gap between the haves and have-nots.
Right.
How much is enough for me? How much do I give? Right. You know, where's the balance? It's just, these are huge questions.
And I think it's always amazing that people have grasped the fact that middle-class incomes have stagnated. That there's this enormous gulf between the rich and the middle class. I mean, everybody's heard Bernie's speech so many times, and yet people are still filled with shame about the fact that their personal finances hasn't improved, that they're still, that they feel like they're falling behind. Like, there's the generality, which I accept, but it's still shameful that I somehow, I'm a part of that, that my personal situation doesn't reflect a rising standard of living like everybody else's. Well, they're not having it either, you know, I mean, it's kind of a very odd...
Well, and it's like the idea that, you know, like the shame of having too much or the shame of having too little, and how the culture always is selling us something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's part of it, you know, it's like an education piece that what I find, you know, encouraging generosity is that most everybody wants to be more generous enough.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is a lot of people just don't know how to do it.
Right.
And not only because of the fact they may not be making enough money, but even folks who don't know how to manage the money they have.
Right.
Because, like, well, like in my case, you know, I drive a 15-year-old car. It doesn't look too great. Anytime I have somebody come down and visit, I'm a little embarrassed. But, you know, I'm an executive director of the UMA, and I'm driving around this car. It's 15 years old.
Yeah.
But, you know, I also am a committed tither, and I make different choices at different times. I mean, I have a lovely home, and it's like I'm sure not poor or anything. But I think that the ability for us to be honest and intimate and talk about stuff, in the best situations, that's what religious communities do. I mean, I used to do a lot of teaching in classes on death.
Uh-huh.
It was amazing how people don't even talk about death in their religious community.
Right, like,
It's like, when are we going to have a chance to be intimate and talk about things that most matter? And I'm not saying, obviously, these conversations are happening. But
Well, these are the conversations that are the stuff of religious community, except when the process gets blocked by something else that gets in the way, some social aspect of being in a community where status and shame and embarrassment and, kind of narrow conformity takes over the process, and the religious community turns into its opposite, which is a place where actually, I was always struck. One of my first experiences with this was I went to do a pledge call at a member, at a family in our church that hadn't been around for 6 months. And he told me, quite frankly, he said, I was laid off from my job, and so I stopped going to the church because I didn't want to be in the, I'm going like, well, gee, you know, I mean, like, that's crazy, but it was not crazy to him, you know, and so that's that kind of that kind of stuff.
It's like in pledge, you know, when you have pledge Sunday, the people who don't show up are the people who are ashamed of it. I mean,
right.
Like, you know, and you know, you get this thing, well, if you're at church, you're not supposed to talk about money, and you know, in churches, you know, I know when I came in, I wasn't raised, you know, in a religious tradition.
Mm.
Churches didn't have a lot of credibility around money, from my perspective.
Right.
Because it's almost like it really was. They almost talked about it when they wanted it.
Right.
Like, you know, I mean, I became a tither long before I was a UU, because my wife and I would start doing my first religious community, and they had a thing at the offering where people would talk about generosity. This couple started talking about tithing, and I like, but I was so intrigued. And so, I mean, it's a joke, but it's true. My wife and I said, well, 10%, there must be magic in 10%. So my wife was very good at budget, so we started by, we gave away literally 10% after the mortgage, the food, and the car payments or whatever it was. And so I always say we gave like $25 a month away, and it was 10% of something, right?
Something, right, yes.
And, you know, eventually...
10% of the money you found in the couch.
Over 20 years, we've been given 10% of gross, And it's so funny because it's the most transformational spiritual practice in my life. And it's taught so much. It's taught me about money, but it's taught me about faith. It's taught me about how much I really need. I mean, there's so much in it, you know, and I always joke that I used to do workshops before I became a minister about this. And I would, everybody to have financial peace and prosperity and really feel, give 10% away, save 10%, give 10% away. And then I joked that when I became a minister, I kind of lost credibility in that message because people are like, well, if you're doing that now, you know, it's like, pay off the bills.
The way we went with it, and we peaked around 10%, though we've fallen off a little bit lately because of like a just creepy feeling of insecurity that came with my retirement, was that we started at 2%, and every year we went up either a 0.5% or a 0.5%. So actually, the increase of that we were giving away every you know, every year. Didn't seem like that much, but we built up to temperature. And I recommend that to people because it's a way that you can do that with that. Because 10% free, if you're giving away 1% now, 10% all of a sudden seems like something you can never.
Well,
You did it the other way.
I think I read it.
So we'll do 10%.
The good news is I'm not very good at that, so it's easier. It's like you just move a decimal point.
Right, there you go.
So maybe like tithing for dummies. Yeah. Right.
It'll be only about one page long.
But the important piece is, like I say, people want to be generous. Mm-hmm. But so often, people don't learn the skills of how to manage and use money. In college, and so to even talk about tithing, there's like, well, no, there's other things you have to do too. It's like it's not like people. Sometimes people say, well, I was born knowing money and finance. No, you can learn this stuff. But and like, what? How much is enough? And how do I make those decisions? Do I really, you know, go to Starbucks and get the coffee? Or you know, I mean, it's like when I was in seminary, it stunned me how many people. You know, I was working part time through seminary. My wife had to go back full time, and I was obviously a middle career guy. But I would bring my lunch every day. It's just as simple as that. My colleagues, many of them,
who were like, going out.
Berkeley's got great places to eat. But yeah, it's amazing how.
Yeah.
I think that's the disconnect that our culture causes for us. That it's like, this is how we think we need to be, and it's like. The truth is, I mean, you have to make different choices. And I don't think that those choices, even in our circles of Unitarian Universalism, I don't think those always are embraced. And it's like a little embarrassing to drive a 15-year-old car for your lunch to something.
Well, I think we're out of time here on this episode of The View, our special episode.
Thank you for that.
But thank you, Don, for coming. And thank you, Bob, for your great engineering.
Pleasure.
And next week on The View, we'll be back to our, I guess we had a regular edition of The View earlier today.
We did. Second edition of The View.
I know.
We're
on our path to becoming a 24-hour cable.
24-hour view station. Where do I give? I want to donate to that.
Right. And so, thank you. We'll see. I don't know. I forget what's up next week, but something wonderful and good. And we'll all see you next Thursday morning.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.